Well, now to another long-running conflict, this one ecological. On the savannas of Africa, giant elephants are pitted against angry ant swarms that live in trees. And according to a new study, one of the worst things that could happen in this conflict is for the two sides to find peace. NPR's John Nielsen has more.
If trees could feel emotions, there is nothing that would scare them more than the sight of an approaching elephant, according to Todd Palmer, an ecologist with the University of Florida at Gainesville.
Elephants eat trees. They don't eat parts of trees. They can eat a tree, much like we would eat a cupcake.
We reached Palmer on a cell phone at his research site in Kenya. That's where he goes to study a small African tree that has found a way to repel hungry elephants. Palmer says these trees ooze tasty sap that attracts nasty ants and then makes the ants even nastier. He says a single one of these trees can hold 100,000 of the ants, which is very bad news for any elephant that decides to chow down on a branch.
So imagine 100,000 ants streaming across the tree towards this point of disturbance. At some point, enough is enough, and you're going to have a face covered in these biting, stinging ants.
Palmer says he's watched these ants charge straight into an elephant's trunk, which is famously sensitive. Now, scientists call this kind of ant-tree alliance a mutualism, which has a kind of peaceful ring to it, but not in this case, according to Palmer.
It's a co-evolutionary war. People think of mutualisms as a friendly sort of situation where species are helping each other out. But what it really is a battlefield.
And on this particular battlefield, a tiny insect trumps the biggest land animal on Earth. But that got Palmer wondering, what would happen to the ant-tree alliance if the common enemy, elephants, was gone? To find out, he put great big fences up around some of his trees, which are known locally as whistling thorns, and then he watched them for 10 years. Palmer expected these trees to flourish with no elephants around, but no. Some of them grew half as fast as before, and many died, and all of them stopped producing that tasty sap. That drove off all the ants that had once guarded them from the elephants.
These trees, in the absence of herbivores, decided, well, the herbivores are gone, so it doesn't make a lot of sense to pay these ant bodyguards as much. So let's reduce the salary, in essence, that we're paying these bodyguards.
Palmer says the sap reductions turned out to be a big mistake. That's because the guard ants were quickly replaced by other insects that attacked the trees, digging lots of ugly holes and tunnels.
Like the tree's riddled with cancer or something. It's basically, if you cut open a cross-section of a tree, all it is just this torn-up inside with massive numbers of tunnels and dead branch systems everywhere.
This is an experiment that shows just how powerful and complicated natural alliances can be, says Mark Burtness, a biologist with Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. But more importantly, he says, it shows that you never know what you're going to get when you mess with Mother Nature.
And this is a great example of how, without these mutualisms, the community collapses.
Burtness says it's possible that similar collapses could take place in other parts of Africa where elephant populations are now in trouble. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.
Switching gears now from history to a very modern problem. Maybe you're like me and you just got the Christmas decorations down and the presents put away. And maybe you got a new flat screen TV or some other hot new device that's all the rage. If so, congratulations. But what are you going to do with the old device? What's called e-waste is causing serious health and environmental problems in developing countries. A few states have passed legislation that requires manufacturers to recycle their products. It might just be the next big thing, but is that enough? I'm joined by Barbara Kyle of the Electronics Take Back Coalition and Garth Hickle, Product Stewardship Team Leader for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, to talk about this. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Barbara, if you'd start us off, what is e-waste?
E-waste, electronic waste, is really anything with a circuit board in it. So it's computers, televisions, cell phones, DVD players.
And Garth, what's the scope of the problem? Just in Minnesota, how much e-waste do you think we generate each year?
Well, it is extremely difficult to actually get a handle on that because we don't have a sense of actually how much was sold during a particular year and then how much has been subsequently recycled or disposed of. But we do have some estimate on the sales of products. And in Minnesota, we estimate that about 48 million pounds of video display devices, televisions, computer monitors, and laptops were sold in the state in 2006.
Wait. 48 million pounds in one state in one year?
Yes.
Okay.
Nationally, there's a figure that the recyclers put out of about 400 million units of e-waste scrap each year. So 400 million things, TVs, DVD players, all those each year get scrapped.
What happens to it? Because I was thinking about this, because in my neighborhood, there's a recycling event that they have maybe every quarter or so. And they, you know, set it up very well. And there's a place you can go specifically to take your e-waste. And then I'm thinking, okay, what happens then?
Well, sadly, an awful lot of it isn't really recycled. And what happens with an awful lot of it is it gets very minimally processed here, where the recycler might take out some of the most profitable parts to the computers in particular, and then the rest of it gets shipped overseas, usually to developing countries, a lot of it going to Asia, China in particular. And there, it's really almost virtually dumped. It goes into areas where there's some pretty primitive processing that happens. If you can just picture literally backyard recycling yards where people are bashing open the electronics and removing some of the metals, because that's what they can get some money from, and then dumping the rest and burning it. When you burn these things, it emits dioxin, which is a horrible thing to be breathing in. And all this is happening right next to where people are working and living.
If you would just clarify for me, why does so much of this waste go to Asia? It's so that it can be scavenged?
Well, recyclers can make money selling it there. And there is a market for this very primitive system of recycling where they can make money off removing the metals. And many of these countries just don't have the kind of regulatory infrastructure where they can prevent it from happening, prevent it from coming in. So if it comes in a way that the government knows about it, they will say, no, we won't take it. But it's all illegal import.
What are the negative effects of that kind of recycling? Well, you said people just basically dump it, burn it. What's wrong with that?
Well, I mean, it's a horrific exposure problem to the communities there. The people that are handling it basically have no kind of protective equipment. You'd think they'd have literally no gloves, no respirators. They're breathing in these chemicals. Then when they burn it, the whole communities are breathing in these toxic chemicals. It's getting into their water systems. In an area of China called Guayu, contaminant levels are so high, they have to truck in all of their water. So it's bad enough what we're doing to those communities. But very recently, there's been some work tracing some of these toxins back to us. So the study that was done by a professor in Oregon has traced the lead that is in some of the children's jewelry that's purchased at, you know, discount stores to lead in solder, lead from electronic waste. So the circle of poison really is coming all the way back to us.
Garth, Minnesota has passed some tough laws regarding e-waste. If you could just briefly tell us, what do these laws require?
Well, our law is a producer responsibility approach so that manufacturers of video display devices, the televisions, monitors, and laptops, have an obligation to collect and recycle a certain percentage by weight of what they sold the previous year.
So, advice to the consumer who cares and wants to make a difference. What should they do?
So, yeah, I would say there's two things that consumers can do. One is that actually in our coalition, we have a pledge program that responsible recyclers have pledged to not follow these low-road practices, not export. And so people can go on our website and find recyclers in their area. They can click on the map on their state. But the other thing that consumers can do is start to really ask the companies that they're buying their products from to offer take-back programs, because consumers have some power in their purchasing dollars to say, I want to buy products from companies who will take them back from me when I'm done with it and recycle them responsibly.
Barbara Kyle is the National Coordinator for the Electronics Take Back Coalition. She joined us by phone from Delaware. Garth Hickel is the Product Stewardship Team Leader for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. He joined us by phone from North Carolina. You can find out more at our website, npr.org/tellmemore. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
When driving rain slammed the West earlier this week, there was fear and celebration. Fear of mudslides, celebration for all that water. In western residential areas, much of it will run off and go to waste. And Brad Lancaster is on a crusade to keep that from happening. He lives in parched Tucson, Arizona, and has written a book of tips on how you can harvest rainwater. We called him to find out exactly what that means.
It could mean one of three things. The easiest is if you just harvest that water in the soil and use the soil as your tank. You create these bowl-like shapes in the landscape that collect water. You mulch the surface and plant them so the water quickly infiltrates, and then the plants become your living pumps. So you then utilize that water in the form of a peach, a pomegranate, an apple, wildlife habitat, and beauty.
What would be the second way that water is harvested?
Well, number two would probably be what most people think of, and that's the harvest of rainwater from a roof into a tank or a cistern. The third would be then harvesting our household wastewater. That would be our gray water, the water from our shower, bathtub, bathroom, sink, washing machine. That's an excellent source of water that we can reuse to passively irrigate our landscapes in times of no rain.
Yeah, there is a statistic that you cite that is pretty astonishing as to how much drinking water is used for landscape irrigation generally.
Yeah. 30 to over 50% of the potable drinking water currently consumed by the average single-family home in America is used for landscape use. And we found that you can provide all or at least 95% of the irrigation water needs just with rainwater and gray water.
Does this make sense in our cities that are not in, say, real dry areas, but maybe going through droughts? And I'm thinking here of Atlanta, Georgia, and the whole Southeast where it's been in the middle of a drought. Is this viable for these places when really at some point the drought will be over?
Absolutely, because the great thing about rainwater harvesting is it works in both wet and dry contexts. In the wet context, it greatly reduces flooding downstream. And then in the dry contexts, it buffers the droughts of the dry seasons.
How hard is it to start harvesting rainwater?
What's the
startup cost? What's involved?
Yeah, the price of a shovel, basically.
Oh, no, it's at least the price of a big barrel, too.
No. You can start just by changing the topography of your yard. Just create some basins around your trees, or if you don't have any trees yet, create some basins beside which you can plant a couple low-water-use native trees. That's the easiest way to start. And then if you want to step up, then you can put in a barrel or a tank. But there is a risk if you do this. You'll get so excited that even if it rains at 3 a.m., you'll likely find yourself running out in the pouring rain in just your underwear just to watch the tanks and the earthworks fill up.
Now, are you speaking from experience?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've got a bit of a reputation in the neighborhood.
Well, Brad, thank you very much for talking to us about this.
You bet. Thank you.
Brad Lancaster is the author of Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands and Beyond. To see how Brad Lancaster turns Tucson's 12 inches a year of rain into 100,000 gallons of water on his property alone, check out npr.org.
Two years ago, most Americans got an introduction to a term they'd never heard of.
Switchgrass.
That's President Bush during his 2006 State of the Union address. He presented a laundry list of things his administration would do to help America kick its oil habit.
We'll also fund additional research and cutting-edge methods of producing ethanol, not just from corn, but from wood chips and stalks or switchgrass.
Since then, a lot of switchgrass has been through the mill, so to speak, but there's been little evidence that growing grass could actually make a dent in our demand for oil. Now there's new research showing that this prairie plant could be a good source of ethanol. Here's NPR's Christopher Joyce.
Right now, Americans get their ethanol fuel from corn, so much of it that corn prices have been bouncing up near their historical ceiling. A lot of economists say if the country wants more ethanol, it should not come from food. Thus, switchgrass. It's a kind of prairie grass, but you don't have to go to the prairie to find it. For example, it grows on the banks of the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland, where Ken Staver has been tending a plot for years. It's 6 feet high, yellowish, and stiff as a pencil.
Actually, you can see it's doing, you know, it's done very well here with very little care. Other than when we planted it 10 years ago, we used some herbicide during the establishment phase. But since then, there's literally the only thing we do out here every year is harvest it.
Switchgrass contains cellulose, the starting material that, with enough heat and the right enzymes and chemicals, can be made into ethanol fuel. Staver, a scientist with the University of Maryland, says one of the good things about this grass is that it pretty much grows by itself.
It's considered a perennial plant. So it does reseed some, but mostly these are the original plants. It's not growing back from seedlings every year. It's growing back from the same rootstock.
So you don't have to plant it every year or even fertilize it much, and it's easy to harvest. And these things are essential if you want to make fuel from plants, biofuels. The more energy you use to make them, say gas for tractors or electricity to convert them into liquid fuel, the lower your net energy yield. In short, if it takes close to a gallon of gasoline to make a gallon of biofuel, why bother? Well, plant scientist Ken Vogel at the federal government's Agricultural Research Service in Nebraska has done a new study that says switchgrass is worth the bother. Vogel spent 5 years with farmers growing switchgrass in the Midwest. It was one of the biggest experiments with actual crops. He calculated, with what might seem like mind-numbing thoroughness, everything that went into each plot.
And this includes the energy used for fuel, the energy used to make the tractors, the energy used to produce the seed to plant the field, the energy used to produce the herbicide, the energy used to produce the fertilizer, the energy used in the harvesting process.
Vogel says for every unit of energy used to grow the switchgrass, he could get almost 5.5 units worth of ethanol out. And that's a lot more efficient than making ethanol from corn, he says.
The bottom line is perennial energy crops are very net energy efficient. It is going to be economically feasible. The basic conversion technology has been developed, and it is going to be a viable process.
Now, Vogel has focused on the growing part of the process mostly. He hasn't demonstrated that commercial distilleries can actually achieve this same level of efficiency. One issue is how you power your distillery. If you use electricity made from coal, you lose some of the advantage of biofuels. Vogel argues that a distillery could regain that advantage by burning leftover parts of the switchgrass to generate the energy. Vogel's research appears in the latest issue of the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Okay, from polar bears now to tigers and a wildlife biologist who is in trouble with some human rights activists. He is Alan Rabinowitz of the Wildlife Conservation Society.
When tigers are able to vote under what governments they can try to survive, then maybe I'll consider the political framework under which I have to save them.
Alan Rabinowitz is trying to save them in Myanmar, or Burma, run by one of the most notorious military dictatorships in the world. It brutally put down protests by Buddhist monks a few months ago.
But Myanmar also has some of the best wildlands left anywhere. And working with that notorious government, Alan Rabinowitz has established large wildlife reserves, including the world's largest for highly endangered tigers. He tells the story and acknowledges his critics who say he shouldn't be there in his new book, Life in the Valley of Death.
To say that I won't work somewhere, especially somewhere which may be able to save the last tigers of the world because of the politics, I think that's an incredibly selfish view, actually. So we wait for a regime which is subjectively satisfactory to a certain group of people, and in the meantime, we have no more tigers, no more Asian elephants, no more primates. What have we accomplished?
In setting up this massive tiger reserve in northern Myanmar, you recount in your book how you've been dealing with these people in the forestry department, and suddenly on one of your trips there, the forestry department is suddenly aligned with the head of intelligence. Now, this is maybe the number two or three person in the entire country, and you're dealing at a whole other level there.
Everything from the village headman to the prime minister or to the head of military intelligence at the time. It's very funny because I never planned it in any certain sequence or in any way. I never sought to go after any particular individual in order to further my agenda.
You're a biologist. I mean, you're a wildlife biologist.
Well, I wonder sometimes. I am trained as a wildlife biologist. Now I'm trying to figure out what I am. Sometimes I feel more like a politician of sorts than a wildlife biologist. But that is my training.
Why is it that the military dictators of Myanmar, people who are shunned by almost all of the world, why is it, do you think, that they have an interest in creating these conservation areas?
The bottom line is they truly like tigers. They actually don't want to be in charge over a country which has lost its tigers under their watch. And it's a very interesting mindset because no matter what else people think of them, they see themselves as guardians of the people, as ironic as that might sound.
What did you think when you saw the recent demonstrations by the monks there in Myanmar, demonstrations that were put down quite severely by the military with the imprisonment of, reports of thousands?
Well, I wasn't there, so I really didn't see anything firsthand. How it was handled by the government is something I actually can't speak to because I've heard different reports. My own people in Yangon tell me that the crowds were not nearly as large as the media reported, that the shooting was not nearly as intense. But I don't know what's true and what's not true.
You know, Alan, some people listening to this would say right there, Alan Rabinowitz is crossing the line.
I know. I thought that as I was saying it.
He is saying, I don't know what's going on there, when we have reports and videotape of people being shot, and we have many reports of people being imprisoned. And how can you not know?
How can I not know? You do not have videotape of many people being shot. There is no videotape of many people getting shot there. There is videotape of a Japanese reporter getting shot. This is what I get very disturbed about, is that when it comes to Myanmar, people seem to want to deal in a lot of rhetoric and a lot of preconceived notions rather than pure facts. Yes, this government is not the nicest government in the world, but what I have seen in that country doesn't match up with what the media tries to portray as happening in that country. And I don't quite understand why people love to hate Myanmar. I'm not an apologist for them. If anybody reads my books, they see that I talk very strongly about some of the bad things which are occurring in that country. But I balance everything with talking about what's happening that's good and what's happening that's bad. And the government seems to respect that kind of balanced honesty.
Alan Rabinowitz of the Wildlife Conservation Society, based in New York. He's the author of Life in the Valley of Death. Alan, thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. Two stories now on big, iconic animals that conservation groups use to arouse people about threats to the environment.
First, polar bears. Three groups say they will sue the government to force it to protect the bears.
NPR environment correspondent Elizabeth Shogren is with us. Elizabeth, this is about whether polar bears should be counted an endangered species, yes?
Well, it's slightly different, actually. What the government has proposed doing is putting them on the endangered species list as a threatened species, which the difference means that there is a threat that they will become extinct in the future in a big portion of their range. So one of the things that's interesting about this is the polar bear would be the first species that would be put on the endangered species list because of global warming.
And this has to do, the Arctic ice is going away. They depend on the Arctic ice. So for sure, bad things are going to happen to them.
Well, that's what scientists say. They've looked really thoroughly at lots of studies, and they've come up with a prediction that by the middle of this century, two-thirds of the bears that are now roaming the Arctic will be gone, and they'll be gone from most of their current range.
There are 25,000 polar bears in the Arctic region. If they were counted as an endangered species, certainly, that would trigger some consequences. Things would have to happen. And so there are some groups against this listing.
That's right, particularly the industries that use the Arctic or hope to use the Arctic more widely in the future. And first on the list is the oil extracting industry. And they say that it's not a good idea and that it's wrong for the government to list them.
The governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, had an op-ed piece in the New York Times last weekend arguing also against this listing. And she noted that there are more polar bears in Alaska now than there were 40 years ago. Is she right?
Well, the data is a little bit different than that. What the government scientists have produced as part of their study to try to decide whether or not to put the bears on the endangered species list, they've been able to show that, in fact, the populations probably are pretty stable so far, but polar bear cubs are not surviving at a very strong rate. And the scientists say if the cubs don't survive, that's going to have an impact on the population along the way.
When is the decision going to come on this, and what happens next?
Well, what the government said earlier this week when they postponed their decision is that they hope to have the decision within a month. The timing is an important issue here because the government has also told us that they're planning early next month to lease to offshore leases for oil drilling in the Chukchi Sea, which is the big sea between the U.S. and Russia. And it'll be interesting to see what happens there, whether the government is going to lease this huge area for offshore drilling at the same time that it's saying that the polar bear is threatened.
NPR's Elizabeth Shogren.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.